Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the fabulous fireside room, the speaker is David Lund, and he will be speaking on Israel, the people, and the state. So let's listen in on David.
It's a delight to have so many people who are interested in this topic. This is a topic that I teach regularly on, and often in the company of a friend of mine who's a rabbi in Seattle. He originally had planned to come and be here this week, but his work being what it is, it took him out of town. So you just get me. But tomorrow, Friday, we'll have session 4, and that'll be at 10:30 in the morning in this room. And Saturday is at 10:30 in the morning in here as well. So we get this room the rest of the time. And we get that nice morning time slot tomorrow and the next day. How many of you were here yesterday?
Two people.
Okay, I told you that, by the way, you can start the tape if you're listening. I told you that yesterday, if you had any questions that weren't answered, if you would please write them down. Are there any questions that you wrote down or anything from yesterday that you want to ask and bring up before we jump in? Any questions that you were sort of wondering about after the last class yesterday? Well, what I'd like to do then is finish up the section on Torah, which is on, let's see, if you turn to page 5. Yesterday we talked about the 4 different kinds of Torah law: reflexive laws that affect the doer, ethical laws that affect relationships between people, holiness laws that affect the relationship between a person and God, and national laws which affect the life of Israel as a community, as a nation, people. And then we looked at the Sabbath as a complex or a large body of Torah law, and we talked about how Sabbath laws fall into each of those 4 categories. Well, today I'd like to finish that discussion, and it's number 9 under Torah on page 5. On the outline, it's number 9. And the second example I chose to sort of get your mind going along with this idea of 4 different categories of Torah law, and I chose kashrut, or dietary law. The reason I choose kashrut is while some people are familiar with Sabbath and Sabbath laws, very few people really have any understanding and any depth of dietary law in Judaism. A Jewish friend of mine once said, I once was talking with a non-Jew, in this case it was a Christian, about dietary law, and the person said, "Oh, that's when the rabbi blesses some food and then it's kosher, right?" And he laughed so hard he almost split his sides. You know, the idea of this rabbi, rabbi assigned to a food processing plant, blessing things as they went by. He found that very humorous. Basically, what that was the person was thinking of a rabbi as a priest. You know, priests bless things and pastors bless things. So they were thinking of kind of a priest or something like that, but a Jewish version. So he said, from that time on, I knew that I had to be a little more deliberate about teaching what dietary law was really all about. So let's talk about the 4 different categories. The first category is the reflexive laws, and many of the dietary laws are reflexive. In other words, obeying the law affects the doer. Doing the commandment affects the doer of the commandment. And it's not ethical, it just really affects you who do it. There's something out of the Midrash, a quote that I give you there. It says, "Kashrut commandments were given solely in order to train people." It's very interesting. And the principle of kashrut is limiting what you can kill and eat. Now, was anyone in my Genesis course last week? You were. In the garden, in paradise, nobody eats meat. Okay, they're vegetarian. Then after sin comes into the world, and especially after the flood, after this massive explosion of sin that is has to be answered with a flood, literally a wiping out of such great wickedness. After the flood, God starts to give Noah and his children commandments about eating meat. And it's kind of a surprise because they didn't eat meat before. I mean, at least they didn't in the garden. And it's almost like God has realized that part of sin now, part of sinful humanity, is some kind of a desire to eat meat or a lusting after meat. In fact, you could go one step further and say, basically, and you could argue this through just a survey of human history, that sinful humanity seems to have some kind of an attraction to blood as well as meat. So the very first commandments about meat in chapter 9 of Genesis are, you can eat meat, but no blood. You can eat meat, but drain the blood out. Don't drink the blood. Okay? So it's already starting sort of to limit something, to limit the meat eating or the animal consumption. Well, the Sinai laws about dietary matters, kashrut, are much more specific, as many of you may know. And truly the idea is to create self-discipline, self-control, so that people do not eat anything that they would have a craving to eat, but they limit that craving for good purposes. And actually, kashrut works. The fact that in a Jewish community you are so used to dealing with flesh in such a ritualized, restrained kind of way, there's very little cruelty to animals, violence against animals in Jewish communities. And it actually works in the end, the ethical part, we haven't gotten to that yet. But it works. In fact, violence toward people and murder and such things are very rare in Jewish communities. So it actually works. Kashrut commandments do train people in particular ways. Okay, now what animals are kosher and what aren't? Land animals that chew the cud and have split hooves. Okay, so cows, for example, have split hooves and chew cud. Pigs have split hooves, but don't chew cud. That's why they're not kosher. If they ever bred a pig, you know, if genetic engineers ever bred a pig that chewed cud, it would be kosher.
Why is it with the split hooves or chewing cud?
We'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
Wonder about that. I'm going to not answer it for a couple minutes. Why? Okay, fish. Fish that have fins and scales are kosher. But not shellfish. Nothing that doesn't have fins or scales. So eels or shellfish or what are some other fish that don't have? Yeah. Anything that doesn't have fins and scales is not kosher. Okay, and birds? Most birds of prey are out, are not kosher. Most birds that aren't birds of prey are. There are a couple exceptions to that, but that's generally true. Now, there's only one possible rational explanation. I don't even personally buy it, but there's one possible rational explanation that people have come up with, that of all the animals that are allowed, none of them are carnivores. None of them eat meat. And in there's almost a mystical sense that if people don't eat carnivores, they won't ingest that killer instinct. You know, if you don't eat a wolf, if you don't eat a, you know, a tiger or whatever, you know, if you don't eat a carnivore, a meat-eating animal, maybe you won't become a meat-eating animal, or won't at least have that killer instinct. I don't think that's true. I don't think there is any rational explanation to it. I think, and I'm going to answer your question, why split hooves and chew the cud, and you know why that? Why are those kosher and others not? It's a little bit like asking, why does red mean stop and green mean go? There's no particular reason. It just is. And then you live by it. You abide by it.
There's no passage in the Bible that has any of
that. There's no passage in the Bible that gives any rationalization, you know, why this and why not that. It just says these animals, yes,
oh,
these animals, no.
Okay.
Oh, very, very clearly, very distinctly. That's where all the dietary laws come from.
Oh, okay.
From
I'm wondering if the reason they forbid to eat pork is because at that time, pigs, you know, they, how to get the name of this insect, they
Okay, that's a typical conception that especially us non-Jews have, is that kashrut has something to do with health or hygiene. Has absolutely nothing to do with health or hygiene. In the ancient world, you know, cows got just as many parasites as any other thing. I mean, it's got really nothing to do with hygiene at all. What it has to do is the limiting of what you can eat. It, again, Torah law is very realistic about human nature. It just assumes that people will have an urge or desire to eat meat of all kinds, to eat anything that's edible. And you know, God comes in with Torah and says, you can't eat everything. Why? Because you're my people. Because I'm going to teach you. Remember, Torah means teacher. I'm going to teach you to restrain your appetites and not eat everything that you might want to eat for the sake of a greater good.
When this came into being, it was at a time when paganism was taking off and people were massacring animals, drinking the blood in
yes.
the rituals. And in my opinion, this was simply done for discipline, for the people. And to set them apart
right.
from paganism.
Exactly. Did everybody hear that? Mm-hmm. When the Torah laws were given, all of Israel's neighbors were drinking blood. They were eating limbs off of living animals. You know, it's kind of a funny commandment. You shall not eat the limb off a living animal. But they were doing it, apparently. Blood. Somebody who took this class from me came back later and said that they had done some study in Aztec culture, too. You know, as far away as Central America. And whenever there was human sacrifice done, the holy man or whatever, you know, the spiritual person would just take the blood of the victims and cover himself with it, and it would dry and get thick all over, and he would walk around like that for days. It was part of the, you know, just blood everywhere. And in Canaanite religion, in Egyptian religion, in Mesopotamia, in Babylon, there's just blood everywhere in the religious ritual and all over the place. One of the most stunning things that I ever have felt in a movie is, anyone ever see the movie Not Without My Daughter? About a woman who marries an Iranian man and then goes to Iran. And the first thing they did when they celebrated, they got out of the car and they just knifed open this goat or whatever it was. And they wanted him to just jump through the blood and all get all covered with blood as part of the celebration of homecoming. And of course the American woman and her daughter were repulsed. You know, they literally were about to throw up, you know. They couldn't understand, and of course they started off their whole time there on a really bad foot because they would not accept this hospitality, you see. But again, they are shaped by Western culture. They're shaped by a culture that's been shaped by the values of the Bible. So, you're right. It's all about discipline. And you could call kashrut Judaism's compromise with vegetarianism. I mean, the ideal is vegetarianism, but this is a compromise. If you're going to eat meat, fine, but we're going to limit it. We're going to discipline you. Okay, the second dimension of kashrut is the ethical dimension. Remember I told you any Torah laws fall under at least two of the four categories? Reflexive, ethical, holiness, or national? Well, kashrut falls, dietary laws often fall into all four. Okay, a kosher animal is not necessarily kosher. Or you could almost make a joke. When is a kosher animal not kosher? Is when it wasn't killed painlessly with one cut of a very sharp knife. Painless slaughtering. That's why hunting is completely and utterly out of bounds in Judaism, and always has been, because what happens? You may wound the animal and not kill it. It causes lots of pain and suffering on the part of the animal, and that animal would never be kosher, even if it was by type a kosher animal.
Does that mean like major companies in the United States, like Manischewitz and stuff, actually like have their own farms how do they really adhere to that?
Well, you see, you mean with meat? I mean, most stockyards you know, kill animals painlessly, just as a matter of course. So, you know, there are very few that don't. In more strict interpretations, in many Orthodox circles, they really have trouble with chickens, with the way chickens are treated in factory farms. Because it's just incredibly inhumane, you know, the way chickens are raised in factory farms. And many observant Jews will not eat anything except free-ranging chickens, not because the animal itself is not kosher, but because part of kashrut is how you treat the animal, you know, how you raise it and how you slaughter it. Very important. And some, in some Reform Jewish circles that expand Torah in more progressive or applying Torah laws to new situations, Reform rabbis have taken a stand against seals that are clubbed to death for their fur. Now that has nothing to do with, you know, the biblical laws about kashrut, but it's in the spirit of kashrut. That they have told their people that, you know, to buy and wear anything that has to do with that is just not kosher because of the way the animal is treated. Okay. What was the goal? Well, traditionally the rabbis have always said the goal of kashrut was to cause revulsion at the shedding of blood. To not touch it, to be disgusted by it, to discourage that instinctive bloodthirst so that people literally acquire a second nature. And see, here's another way to understand Torah. Torah laws assume people are a certain way by nature, but the assumption is that if you do something contrary to your nature long enough, you will develop a second nature. You will do things that aren't natural almost effortlessly without thinking about it. And can you think of areas in your life when that's been true? When you've done something that wasn't natural to you, but it became natural. That is the goal. That's the goal of all Torah, is for people to acquire new natures and be sort of trained and disciplined in ways that ways of goodness and of wholeness that become kind of second nature. Yeah. All right. Holiness. Oh, I'm sorry.
This doesn't mention anything about having fur coats made from the animals that are trapped. How do you feel about
If an animal is trapped, it'd be absolutely unkosher because the way it would die. I mean, so not only is there this compromise element in terms of limiting animals by type, but kashrut also has to do with ethical treatment of animals. It was revolutionary in the ancient world. Absolutely revolutionary. Okay, holiness aspect. The whole idea, as we talked about yesterday, of holiness is to raise human activity from the animal-like to a higher level. Most holiness laws have to do with activities that we share with animals, most notably eating and sex. And kashrut, the whole... that's a whole dimension of kashrut, that it just raises eating from an animal-like level to a higher level. Israel is called to eat in a way that is ritualized and disciplined, and you are reminded every time you eat that every animal is a creature of God. Every time you eat a kosher animal, you think about the way that the animal was painlessly slaughtered. And you might even think about cutting back on your consumption of meat in general. All right, and then the national dimension of dietary law, in other words, the dimension that sustains Judaism and the Jewish community, is really something that I wouldn't have thought of unless my friend had told me. He says, you know, I keep kosher, and he travels a lot. He says, no matter where I travel in the world, you know, wherever I go, whether it's Asia, China, Latin America, you know, massively different cultures, different languages. He says, when I go there and I seek out a place to find kosher food, I always come into contact and I always have instant friends. In other words, observing kashrut makes you a somebody, not a nobody, when you're somewhere. When you're a stranger, you're not anonymous. You're all of a sudden a person, you're a fellow Jew, you're a a committed religious observant Jew, and you're not just an anonymous nobody. And that ties people together, and that's something about dietary law that I had never thought of, but it is definitely part of the national dimension of the Torah laws that deal with kashrut. So, does that help you to understand Torah a little bit better, to take another example and look at the different ways that it works itself out in people's lives? Anything you'd like to comment on, ask about?
Oh, when you're in a grocery store and you see things on the shelves that are kosher foods, but they're not meat, or, you know, they're crackers or something like that, I don't quite understand. How does that get to be kosher?
Well, if crackers are kosher, then you can be sure that they were manufactured without any animal products, without any unkosher animal products. See, a lot of processed food is processed with animal products, see? And so, you know, yeah, I mean, grains and stuff, I mean, everything, every plant is kosher, right? But anything that might have contact with animal products, then you need to know whether the animal was kosher or not.
So they don't need to bless a plant food?
No. No, they don't need to bless anything. I mean, like I say, Jews think that's really funny, you know. A rabbi, you know.
So what is a rabbi doing there? Just watching?
A rabbi isn't there. There's no rabbi there.
They do inspect plants.
They inspect. Occasionally, certain Jewish bodies will inspect a plant, but it's purely for the reason to see how the animals are being slaughtered. You know, to see if the proper ritual things are being respected in the slaughter of the animals. That would be why they would visit a meat factory.
So they would never visit, like, for the matzah bread, you know, that's kosher. I don't really understand. So the only thing that is kosher is that it doesn't have animal.
Well, matzah is different because it's for Passover. And if it's kosher, if it's got a kosher symbol and it's matzah, that certifies that there's no yeast in it. Oh. It's unleavened.
Mm-hmm. Aren't there a couple of symbols?
Hmm?
I said, what about dill pickles and kosher?
Yeah, that's something that I don't know about. But it's the same principle, though.
But they don't bless it. That's like
a
myth.
No, it's the way it's grown, what kind it is, and how it's prepared.
Would this be like?
Yeah, it's a mess. Yeah.
All Jews, like Orthodox, Reformed, Conservative.
All observant Jews, all Jews who observe commandments, and there are most. I mean, all Orthodox are observant. Mm-hmm. Most Conservative Jews are somewhat observant, and a minority of Reformed Jews are observant. But increasingly, more Reformed Jews are discovering observance and. In fact, in the next 10 to 20 years, I suspect that you'll see a continued increase in the number of religious Jews who are, you know, Jews who belong to a religious community who do observe. But there are different levels of observance, too. You know, I have a friend who says, I just love shrimp, you know? He says, and what I do is I eat shrimp once a year. And he says, and I go out. You know, I'm on vacation or I go out, I don't eat it in my house, and just once a year. Well, now, you know, if you're real legalistic, and some Orthodox would say to him, you know, you're not keeping kosher, you are, you know, you're not observant. But he would say that he is, and, you know...
That's pretty disciplined.
Is what he... Yeah. I mean, is he living in the spirit of kashrut? I would say yes. You know, he's eating it only once a year, and even when he does, he doesn't eat it at home. His home is kosher, you know. So, you know, I really... there are very few Jews anymore, you know. Orthodox Jews are less than 10% in North America. And even among most Orthodox, they're not that legalistic about it. They'd rather... I mean, the general attitude that I perceive in Jewish communities is something is better than nothing, and more is always better than less. But, you know, be realistic. Some people, because of their jobs, just can't keep all dietary law. Well, keep the ones you can. You know, it's We tend to picture Judaism as real legalistic, and in fact, in the 20th century, it isn't, especially in North America. Something is better than nothing.
Would most large hospitals have a kosher kitchen?
Yes, they would. Just out of respect for any observant Jews who happen to be patients. All right. Any more? These are really good questions, and I want you to ask questions about this if you still...
I think the OU is a symbol that I've seen, the circle of the U, or the union symbol.
Yeah.
I've seen that on soap.
Now there you'd have to ask the Orthodox what that's all about. And you see something going on there is that the Orthodox would have even stricter regulations about different products than, say, the Conservative or the Reform.
In a kosher home in which I ate, I noticed they were very careful about how they washed their hands and washed the dishes. Mm-hmm. Do you want to comment a little bit about that in relation to kashrut?
Well, the washing, I don't know if you'd even directly call that kashrut.
She did.
She did?
Yes.
Okay. Because that's more part of the meal ritual. Again, I don't know a lot about the washing, other than it's commanded.
Yeah, right.
And it's not necessarily hygienic. Sometimes you just dip your hands in water. And you don't really wash at all. You call it washing, but you don't really wash. It's just a ritual thing.
I worked at a Jewish home. The first job I ever had was doing housework.
Right.
And the first thing I learned was that you had two separate sets of dishes.
Dishes, that's right.
You wash them separately.
And in Orthodox kitchens, you even have two separate...
Right.
In Orthodox homes, you even have two separate refrigerators.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you have one set of dishes for milk... Well, that milk can touch, and one set that meat can touch. And you never do milk and meat. They never come into contact. Now, that's another thing. What's the point of that? It goes back to the commandment, you shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. And there are other laws that say you separate milk from meat. Well, why is that? The reason, I think, the most prevalent in interpretation, and definitely the one that I would follow, is this. That, going way back into biblical times, milk always represented life, and meat always represented death. And it's the same reason that you don't touch a corpse, or you don't stay ritually clean if you touch a corpse, is that life and death are to be kept separate. Okay? And, the people of Israel are not to touch death. Are not to come in contact with death. And one of the ways that you do that is by this milk and meat, the separate dishes. Again, why might that be? Well, the main theme, what's the main holy book of ancient Egyptian religion? Does anyone know? It's the Book of the Dead. Many pagan worldviews are really involved with the dead, with ancestor worship, with death. And right away, one of the earliest Torah laws are about not touching a corpse, and with that, keeping death and life separate. It's again, it has an ethical dimension. By doing it, you learn something. You learn about what is life and what is death, and as in Deuteronomy says, hopefully you choose life. I don't know if that helps you at all. By the way, that is why in the Good Samaritan story, why the first two won't help the person lying, the injured one lying in the ditch, is because in case he's dead. In case it's a corpse, they can't touch it. That's really the reason that they don't stop to help. Not just because they're selfish or they probably were very good people, but they were observant and they couldn't touch the corpse. And if he's lying there still, you don't know if he's dead or not. And to kick him to see if he's alive, you'd have to touch him. I mean, that's the thing. And of course, the Samaritan, you know, is doesn't observe in the same way and is willing to touch the person. Any other questions?
Now, this doesn't mention beverages at all, like alcoholic beverages or wine or.
There are laws about wine and stuff, but I don't think it would fall directly under this.
But they did drink wine.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting that, well, usually, I mean, rates of alcohol abuse among observant Jews are very low compared to other peoples, and it's interesting that what I found out is that when Jews in North America are not observant and not religious, the rate of alcohol abuse and alcoholism is the same as the national average, but among the observant, it's much lower. So there's less consumption of alcohol in general, but only Judaism is the only religion that commands you on certain festivals to drink a lot. I mean, in Purim, you drink. You're supposed to drink until you can't tell the difference between Haman and Mordecai. You know, I mean, it's a commandment. You know, and even on Passover, if you're the one drinking the wine, you know, you better not be the first time. Okay. All right. Well, let's go on and talk about Israel. We've got a half hour. There's a lot to talk about. I said at the beginning that the outline of this course was God, Torah, and Israel. And we first looked at Jewish understandings of God, and now we've looked at Torah, you know, the whole way that Torah works in the life of Israel. And the third part is, of course, Israel. Now, when you say Israel, it's not self-evident what you're talking about. What are you talking about when you say Israel? You're talking about, the ancient kingdom of David. Are you talking about, when Jews are in exile, as they have been since 70 AD until this century. You still talk about Israel, but there's no kingdom in Israel or a nation in Israel. They're spread all over the world. But you still talk about Israel because then you're talking about a people. So Israel, on the one hand, means the Jewish people or all who identify themselves as, you know, God's called, chosen people of Israel. Well, now, of course, in our day and age, Israel means something else, too. It means the state of Israel. But they're not the same. Not the same at all. Commitment to Israel for most Jews means commitment to the nation of Israel as people and as the state. So it doesn't mean only commitment to the Jewish state, but, for example, commitment to Soviet Jews, or today we'd say Russian Jews, who are in trouble. Some other places where Jews are in trouble today. Ethiopia, they were during that Marxist time of Marxist dictatorship. Did you see, you know, those El Al jumbo jets full of Ethiopian Jews being airlifted out of Addis Ababa, being taken to Tel Aviv? So you see, it's the people, wherever they may be. It's still a very high priority of many Jewish organizations to get all the Jews out of Russia. It hasn't gotten any better since the Soviet Union collapsed. In many ways, it's gotten worse. A lot of the really ugly, vicious anti-Semitism in Russia is now free to be expressed. And now people have freedom in Russia to speak, and all kinds of vile and horrible stuff comes out. Some of you heard me talk in my matins. A friend of mine just came back from Poland, and he couldn't believe it. He's been there for 3 years, and he said, I've never experienced such a sick society. It's very, very sad. He said, there are fewer than 4,000 Jews remaining in Poland today. 4,000. And 2,000 of them aren't even Polish citizens. They're international people or diplomats or whatever. And yet, he said nearly everyone in Poland is sure that the reason their country is going down the toilet is because of the Jews. The only Polish citizens that are Jews that are left are all over, say, 65 or 70. In 10 years, 20 years, there won't be any. But it's just really unbelievable. So, commitment to Jews wherever they are, in the state of Israel or anywhere. All right, so what are some things that this involves? Or how does Israel, in this sense, energize all Jews, whether they're secular or religious? Well, one thing is by Aliyah, which means going up to Jerusalem, returning to, and actually going to live in Israel. People who live in Israel, many consider it an obligation today for Jews to go and live in Israel. Many Jews in North America don't agree that it's a religious obligation and you have to be a good Jew. But that's a debate within the Jewish community. Some people go to visit Israel, live there for a year and stuff, work on a kibbutz. There are all kinds of programs where, and increasingly, young people in religious communities in North America are going more and more to Israel for a year or two, working in hospitals, working on farms, getting acquainted with, learning Hebrew, getting acquainted with Israel. And of course, language binds people together, and learning modern Hebrew is a strong way to identify with the people. Modern Hebrew is not biblical Hebrew. I know a lot of Hebrew, the kind that's in the book. Here, modern Hebrew, it's absolute unintelligible to me. If I see it written, maybe a little bit, but not much. There's a lot of Yiddish mixed into it, and it's just a real interesting mix. But it's very Israeli. Another way to identify with Israel is to learn about the history of the issues in the Middle East conflict. And of course, for most Jews, it also involves financial support of good Jewish causes, of the United Jewish Appeal, which originally was solely an appeal to help build up things in Israel after 1948. There are bonds, there are Israel bonds, and other causes, including being involved politically in your country of residence on behalf of Israel. All right, I wrote here, the single most important assurance of the safety of Jews is the state of Israel. There is no other place any Jew from anywhere in the world can go anytime. There's also no better place to live out a faithful Jewish life. And this applies to anyone. I mean, if you are of Norwegian descent and you convert to Judaism and become part of Israel that way, you have a right at any time to be an Israeli citizen. Instantly, the minute you arrive. Anyone who is a Jew may be an Israeli citizen. And there are some cases where it gets fuzzy and the courts have to decide, but by and large, that's the way it is.
Is dual citizenship often, does that happen?
I don't know. Does anybody know if you can be, I would suppose you could be a dual citizen of Israel and the United States. But again, if you wanted to become a citizen of Israel, you'd probably be motivated in such a way that, why would you? You just want to become a citizen of Israel. Probably. If you wanted to at all. In fact, I think more people would want to not become a citizen of Israel until they were really sure. They'd want to retain their, you know, whatever, American, Canadian, British citizenship, whatever it might be. Argentinian.
Does the state of Israel espouse any particular division of the religion?
Division, what do you mean?
Orthodoxy.
Oh, no, now let's talk about this. I put all this up
how
here.
How do you know if somebody's become a Jew?
Well, the only way a born non-Jew can become a Jew is through conversion, and then it means becoming part of the religious, spiritual community of Israel.
But it
and a letter
be,
from your rabbi,
okay.
Basically.
It doesn't have to be Hasidic or Orthodox.
No. You could become a Reformed Jew. And you could go. All right. You can think about two Judaisms of the 20th century. I put here two Judaisms of the 20th and the 21st century. Probably This will probably continue for a long time into the 21st century. But Judaism is the kind of a religion that is constantly changing and is very adaptable, and all kinds of unusual, unexpected things happen, and so who knows. But at least for the foreseeable future, these are the two kinds of Judaisms that there are, that Jews of one sort or another adhere to or identify with. The first is what I call Judaism of the Torah. That is religious or spiritual Judaism. Judaism of the Torah, Judaism of the Bible, Judaism of observance, Judaism of belief in one God, and the chosenness of Israel, and being faithful to God through observance at some level, etc. Being part of a religious community, going to synagogue, keeping the Sabbath, fasting on Yom Kippur, you see. That's Judaism of the Torah. And there are three basic kinds. There's Orthodox, and that's about 10% or less in North America. Even smaller percent in Israel. And that is, Orthodox Judaism is very committed to Torah, very committed to observing as many commandments, statutes, and ordinances as can be adhered to, which includes things like the fringes. We talked about some of you here when I talked about the fringes who came up and slapped the boy in the face, reminded him of the commandments and who he was. You see Orthodox Jews wearing, you know, prayer shawls with fringes and certain things about clothing. If you went to an Orthodox home, you'd find two refrigerators, two sets of dishes. You'd find people going to synagogue on Sabbath regularly.
And they'd wear their hair in a different way.
Mm-hmm. You'd find people studying the Bible in a fairly serious way. All right, and then there's a branch of Orthodoxy that Hasidism that comes from Eastern Europe, mostly from Lithuania, that part of the world. And those are the people who wear black and black hats, and the men, and they have the curls on the side. Have you ever noticed Hasidic women, they wear whatever they want. They wear fashionable, you know, state-of-the-art dresses, you know, they're dressed to kill sometimes. But just the men dress like that. And you know, there's nothing religious about that getup. It's simply the customary dress of 18th and 19th century Eastern Europe. It's like, what is the town in Lithuania that was such a big center?
The capital?
It's not in Lithuania anymore. Now it's in Belarus. Anyway, Vilna. That's the way people dressed in Vilna in the 19th century.
And the
Hasidim come from Eastern Europe, and that's part of the tradition that they've held to.
What's the connection between Orthodox and the Hasidic?
Very complex.
Oh,
some Orthodox Jews are real suspicious of the Hasidim because they are very free. They're observant, but they're not legalistic at all. They're mystical. They do a lot with mysticism. I mean, the Baal Shem Tov, who is the founder of Hasidism, just sat under a tree and kind of received some mystical experiences and visions and revelations. They do a lot of dancing. They do a lot of like ecstatic dancing. If anyone seen the movie Stranger Among Us, of the undercover cop who has to go and live among the Hasidim, and she experiences some of the ecstatic dancing. They're very filled with joy. In Christian language, we probably call them charismatic. They're very spiritual. They're very attuned to spiritual reality, much more than, you know, the average Western Orthodox person. But that, again, it comes from the East. If you live in a city near a Chabad house, go to a Chabad house sometime. Go to some lecture or something and just experience it. It's really unique and it's really interesting. But they keep kosher. They're observant. It's just that there's this lightness and this joy about it. And it is a renewal movement in Orthodoxy. Hasidism is a renewal movement that really tried to make Orthodoxy less legalistic and less boring, I guess. All right, any more about that? We got, Reform. The Reform movement was started in Germany by a rabbi whose name I forget. Too much sun out here. Anyway, the Reform movement started as an alternative to Orthodoxy for Jews who were serious about being Jewish and about being religious, but no longer saw the value of keeping Torah, of keeping commandments. 19th century progressive humanistic Germany, I guess you'd call it, saying we can be Jews without all of the commandment keeping. And Reform Jews are really the ones that started to do what Christians would call theology. Starting to say, what is the spiritual essence of Judaism, apart from commandments and so forth? And how you eat and what you do at the table and what you wear and all this stuff. And so it was a more liberal, progressive version. And what they wanted to say is you don't have to be Orthodox to be faithful, to be a faithful Jew. So it was an alternative. And of course, it came over to America with the waves of immigrants. It was very big in America, still is. However, a very North American, and when I say that I mean United States and Canada, a very big movement in reaction to Reform Judaism is called Conservative Judaism. And it's based in Hebrew Union College, which is in New York.
New York.
It's in New York. What's the one?
Right across from New York.
The Reform one is in Pittsburgh. Yeah, it's in New York. And what it is a reaction to Reform Judaism. It's people who are saying, well, we're not Orthodox, but Reform Judaism is going out into left field to the point where, in the early part of the century, Reform Judaism, you didn't even have to believe in God. And it becomes so liberal. It was sort of like Unitarianism. With Jewish dress. People reacted to that and they said, no, that we're losing the sense of what it means to be Jewish, what it means to be Israel. And so the conservative movement was born out of that. And most conservative Jews do live the life, do live the way of life, and take that very seriously. Observance, worship, study. Traditional, they're much more traditional Jews, but they're not Orthodox. You see, most American Jews are not willing to be Orthodox. They're American, And yet conservative is kind of a middle position. I find I have found that if I really want to learn about traditional Judaism, I go to the conservative synagogue for classes or seminars or whatever. In a Reform synagogue, you could hear the exact same thing you hear in a liberal Protestant church. Same stuff. Peace and justice, whatever. It's pretty much interchangeable with an Episcopal, education. I'm being grossly unfair in saying that, I know. But do you get what I mean? So, and now, today, conservative Jews that's the largest religious group of Jews in this country and in Canada. Reform is a close second, and Orthodoxy is about 10%. All right, well, there's another kind of Judaism that we have to talk to when we start to talk about Israel. And that is what Jacob Neusner calls the Judaism of Holocaust and Redemption. It's a Judaism that is very young, has only existed since 1945, since the mid-40s, since the Holocaust happened, and since the State of Israel came to be. It's a very new kind of Judaism, and it is secular. It is completely secular. It is not religious. It is a Judaism that is not religious. It's also a Judaism that is political. It's very political. And it's born out of many of the Reform movements of the 19th century, but secular Reform movements. So in Eastern Europe, it basically comes out of Russia, Eastern Europe, not so much in Western Europe. Places where Jews started to feel the weight of anti-Semitism. And there were two approaches. One approach was socialism. There have always been many Jews that have been part of the socialist movement. Now I'm talking way back, I'm talking mid-1800s, when socialism was born. A vision of a more just society through political action. All right, there was a very strong Jewish labor union movement, especially in Eastern Europe. And then it was called Jewish emancipation in the 19th century. And what it meant was fighting for equal rights. Jewish emancipation in the 19th century meant working in such a way that Jews will be seen and treated as equal citizens in a country or in a society, in Russia, in Lithuania, in Germany, let's say. And that was always a very secular movement, and of course these two go together. Many socialists were socially progressive and fighting for that kind of equal rights. And in the 19th century, many Jews still believed that it would be possible through political action to achieve equality and safety from the Jew haters in the societies in which they lived. They were fairly optimistic about that. Okay. Well, starting in 1897, we have something called Zionism. It was born in 1897. Theodor Herzl is the great founder of it. He also was from the East. And he and other people who founded Zionism started to go in a different direction. They started to have a new insight. And it was this. No matter how much political action takes place, no matter how much we work for a just society where we are treated as equal citizens, fairly and justly, they said it isn't going to happen. Herzl said in 1897, it was like a prophet. I mean, everybody thought he was nuts. They thought he was absolutely crazy. In fact, Jews, mostly Jews, thought he was an absolute lunatic when he said the Jew haters are not going to change. Anti-Semitism is not going to go away, and no matter how hard we try to achieve equality and security, we're not going to. And the only answer for Jews is to have their own state, where they are the government, where Jews are the government, and where Jews can truly then live in safety and security. Everybody thought Herzl was a lunatic, and especially when he said, and I predict in 50 years it will be so. He said, people will realize, and then by the time 50 years go by, he said, people will realize it and it will be so. And they people all over the world thought he was a stark raving man. And there were very, very few people who believed in Zionism at all. And in America especially, Zionism was it was just a laugh. People made jokes about it. But you see, Herzl and several people who co-founded it with him, they were very insightful when they said, try as we might, we're not going to change the Jew haters. We're not going to change the anti-Semites. We'll talk more about this tomorrow, because tomorrow the topic is Jew hatred, anti-Semitism, past and present. So we'll delve more deeply into it. But I want you to understand what Zionism was all about and why it started. Now we know the rest of the story. The Holocaust took place. Everything that Herzl said came true. The Nazis set up the death camps, but all the residents of Poland, many of the residents of Poland, Czechoslovakia, Russia, Ukraine, they all helped. In fact, in the beginning, many of them saw Hitler as their savior to finally solve their Jewish problem. Herzl was right. The Jew haters didn't stop. The Holocaust happened. 6 million Jews were murdered in the death camps. And then the world found out about it, and the UN and the whole world basically responded to that situation by giving support for a creation of the State of Israel, which came to be in May of 1948. Immediately had to fight the armies of 10 Arab nations who tried to kill that little state when it began. But as you know, the rest is history. They didn't kill it off. They didn't drive the Jews into the sea as they declared they would. And the State of Israel was able to defend itself. In 1948, there were only 500,000 Jews in Israel. And today there are about 5-6 million and growing. So you've got this whole thing. Now I'm going to answer your question. The foundation of the State of Israel is this Judaism, not this one. In fact, the Zionists said, you people are dreaming. You people who say, we're going to wait around and observe and pray and wait until God redeems us. They basically said they were secular. They many of them were atheists. They said, God is not going to redeem you. By the time that's going to happen, there's going to be no Israel left. If you sit around and observe and go to synagogue and pray and live that religious life, what's going to happen is there's going to be no more Israel. Either people are going to lose interest. Modern people, modern children are going to grow up and not want it. Or you're going to be killed. You're just going to be killed off. They said, you people, you just can't go on this way. And so Zionists and the founders of Israel were all very secular people. David Ben-Gurion was not a religious Jew. He didn't believe in any of the religious parts of Judaism.
You probably said this 10 times over, then what makes them a Jew if it isn't their faith or their religion? And it isn't from where they're from. It's not the Middle East Jew.
Who are the Jews in the first session when I talked about that?
I wasn't here.
No, that's okay. That's okay. Who are Jews? There's two answers to that. Number one, an organized group of people from any background committed to Judaism and its way of improving the world. That would be, through the religion.
Personally.
And Jews are anyone born to Jewish parents.
Oh, okay. So the parents, or their heritage was of
That's
the
right.
first one, but they may be...
Yeah, yes. Zionists are ethnic Jews,
okay.
But they weren't religious at all. It's a secular political movement.
So do you have to then be born into the Judaism of the Holocaust and redemption?
Yes. Yes.
I understand.
That's right. If I, as someone of Norwegian heritage, would become a Jew, it'd be this way.
You can't become a Zionist.
Well, I could too.
Oh, next.
I'm not saying these are totally exclusive.
No.
And in fact, as we get on in the century and as Israel continues to change as a nation, this is changing. And I'll wind up by trying to describe that. When I say secular or political, I mean the original side or the original philosophy of this movement was totally secular, Ben-Gurion and all the rest. And Israel was ruled by socialists for 30 years. By secular, totally unreligious socialists for 30 years until Begin, until the Likud started to come into power.